the war on drugs, while well-intentioned, has been a failure. And that we're warehousing addicted people every day in state prisons in New Jersey, giving them no treatment, sending them back out on the street after their term of incarceration, and wondering why recidivism rates go up and why they don't get better, why they commit crimes again, why they commit crimes to support their addiction. You can certainly make the argument that no one should try drugs in the first place, and I certainly am in that camp. But tens of millions of people in our society do every year. And for some people, they can try it and walk away from it. But for others, the first time they try it, they become an addict. And they're sick. And they need treatment. So I said, what we need to do is for all first-time nonviolent drug offenders, we have to make drug treatment mandatory. Because if you're pro-life, as I am, you can't be pro-life just in the womb. Every life is precious. And every one of God's creatures can be redeemed. But they won't be if we ignore them. And I believe that this program, which was passed overwhelmingly by the legislature this year and will be phased in over the next 5 years, will allow every person who comes into the criminal justice system in New Jersey with a drug addiction to get a year of mandatory drug treatment in-house. And I believe that the results will show after this is fully implemented will be startling, because people can be treated. And miracles happen every day at these facilities. And lives are restored. Mothers and fathers are restored to the heads of their families. Brothers and sisters and sons and daughters are restored to the families. We return fabric to our families by doing this. And by the way, for those of you who are concerned about economics, it cost us $49,000 a year to warehouse a prisoner in New Jersey State prisons last year. A full year of inpatient drug treatment costs $24,000 a year.
Welcome to the second episode of the Central Observer podcast, being brought to you on iTunes. You can follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/C_Observer and like us on Facebook at facebook.com/Central Observer. Today we'll be talking about a topic that's very present both in society and government schemes and has been a prominent factor in talks throughout elections and within policy making of different administrations, both in the United Kingdom, United States, and pretty much all countries around the world. We are joined by a student of politics, a voted Liberal Democrat, and an admitted user of, or previous user of, substance or drugs, Chris Kershaw. Thanks for being with us, Chris.
Thank you for having me.
I'm very interested to start off with asking you why you are refreshingly so, I might add, admitting to drug use.
Well, initially, I don't see it as a blight against my character. I think it is with 2 million cannabis smokers in the admitted cannabis smokers in the UK today. With 10 million people smoking tobacco in the UK today as well. I don't see it as being a blight on my personal character. I think being honest about these things are the way in which you change people's opinion of it in society and later on politically.
Oh, yeah, like I said, it's really refreshing to have someone who is honest and able to talk to us freely without you know, just saying drugs are bad and we shouldn't do them and saying what they think people want to hear. When we mentioned the war on drugs, a lot of people don't realize it actually existed, that there is an actual war on drugs. What is the war on drugs?
Well, the war on drugs, the phrase, the war on drugs, was instituted by Richard Nixon in 1971. He really started the idea of the war on drugs, but really it had been progressing from around about 1914-1920, which saw the end of a time in world history known as the Great Binge, between 1870 and 1940-1920, when drugs were freely available. You could buy heroin kits from Harrods in London. You could buy care packages with cocaine, heroin, speed, cannabis, chocolate and tobacco into centre boys on the front line during World War I. And it was really after the prohibition movement against alcohol and the moral majority, as they termed themselves, started a crusade against what they saw as moral decline in America, especially.
What about the war on drugs that's existent now?
From 1971, the war on drugs really took off in the UK from 1975 with the Misuse of Drugs Act. It has three main aims, which is to decrease demand, decrease availability, and decrease harm, both physical and social, as a result of substances. And these have, in my opinion, been an abject failure. These aims have been
Well, you mentioned them being an abject failure. Why would you view them as being a failure?
For example, in the UK in 1975, we have about 500, maybe just less, heroin users in the UK. And last year, there were 897 deaths because of heroin use. So unless every heroin user in the UK died last year, there has been a sizable increase in the number of people taking heroin. Just as an example, similar statistics are found for cannabis, cocaine, speed especially.
You mentioned that in your opinion that the war on drugs is an abject failure. What would you suggest, in your opinion, would be a better solution for the drug problem that is existent in society? Or, more importantly, do you think that there is a drug problem existent in society?
I believe the problems that are associated with drugs are multiplied tenfold, a thousandfold by their illegality. I'm not denying that there are physical and there are physical harm done by drugs. As I've said, being a former drug taker myself, I have experienced these the physical deteriorations that are part of having taken substances and having ingested these substances. But that is a fact that is completely devoid from the legality side of it, and because of their illegality, they cause far greater harm in society. Because they, as with alcohol prohibition, we saw start gangs, Al Capone, for example. The gang culture, organized crime, really took off during the age of prohibition, and we are living in an age of prohibition today. The only difference is that we have had essentially 45 years of being drummed into us misinformation by governments telling us that these drugs, which are illegal today, are far, far worse than alcohol and tobacco, the things which are legally available. In the mid-70s, Ronald Reagan in 1974, Ronald Reagan quoted the Keith Tulane study about cannabis, in which he said, "The most reliable scientific sources say permanent brain damage is one of the inevitable results of the use of marijuana." However, what wasn't explained during this time, and it took 6 years to be released, was how the study itself was actually conducted. The claim of Dr. Keith and Dr. Tulane was that 30 joints a day were administered to monkeys over 90 days, and after 90 days, they started to atrophy and die. Now, this would be very worrying to any cannabis smoker.
That's taking 30 joints a day.
Yeah, taking 30 joints a day, but after 90 days, they started to atrophy and die. Now, even if we increase this number to take account of the size of human beings, that would still be 30 joints a day over, say, a year, would result in some kind of human death. However, the reality of it, as I say, after 6 years, the reality was revealed that what they actually did was they pumped 63 joints over 5 minutes for 3 months into these chimpanzees, into these monkeys, sorry. However, there was no additional oxygen added to the cannabis smoke. So they were essentially, well, quite literally, suffocated, but with cannabis smoke.
So they had 63 joints, or what is equivalent to 63 joints, put into their system within 5 minutes every day, for how many days?
For 30 days, with absolutely no added oxygen.
So that's the equivalent of 1,890 joints over how many days?
30.
Over 30 days.
Sorry, 3 months.
Over 3 months in 5 minute time periods without any added oxygen.
Yes.
Okay. So it's quite clear why you can't use that study as a basis for policy.
However, this has been the basis for every anti-cannabis move by governments. It has been cited by so many different individuals who did not know the basis of the research, and it has just become common knowledge, quote unquote, common knowledge, that smoking cannabis kills brain cells. when there was a study done in, I forget the name of the university, it was one in China, I will find out for your listeners and give the information.
Yeah, no problem. We can put it on the description.
One done in about, I believe it was 1990s, that suggested that it actually increased brain cell development.
Cannabis.
So, yeah, that cannabis actually increased. So we are operating, the war on drugs is operating under fundamental misconceptions about the substances that they have made illegal.
So pretty much the foundations, before speaking about whether it's been an effective war on drugs or not, the foundations of the surge or the beginning of the war on drugs is rooted in bad research.
It's misinformation and essentially racism and political control. Richard Nixon, as I say, started the idea of the war on drugs.
Right.
And I'm afraid this is a verbatim quote, I don't have it to hand, but said that it was essentially all of the Jews and hippies smoking weed causing trouble.
Right.
So when he then put so much more emphasis on arresting people for cannabis and arresting people for LSD, for example, he was really making a political point. He was arresting his political adversaries and people he didn't like, rather than it being based on any kind of care for people.
So, we've pretty much seen that through, like, in the Western society, that things like alcohol and tobacco, that we know are extremely harmful drugs, have been exploited for their profit value and for their economic value and their profit. My question would be that we know that pretty much a lot of the governments or a lot of the administration in the Western Hemisphere don't have this moral high standing. So why the war on drugs? Why do you think it is that they don't exploit all these drugs for their commercial and profit values, and why have they gone after it with misinformation when, for me, they could be making a lot of money out of it? Is it to go after the electorate voters, or is it the family values that they speak of so often?
I think it was originally, it was first placed as a well-meaning attempt by genuinely concerned citizens that the consumption and essentially enjoyment of substances was in some way major morally deficient in Fiji. It was very, very difficult to bring it to bring back, say, alcohol in America. But eventually, it was because it was something that affected every strata of society. It was something that affected every strata of society, and predominantly affected the upper classes because they were the ones who could afford to buy the best wines, the best scotches, and that kind of thing. Whereas now, I think it's being propelled and propagated because it's very difficult for a politician to turn around to to millions, literally millions of people who have had their lives ruined by this state-sponsored war on its citizenry. It's very difficult for them to then turn around and say, I'm very sorry, I was wrong. I got it completely wrong, and you people shouldn't have been in jail for however long you've been in jail for. You shouldn't have had your children taken away from you. You should have been able to live your life as you saw fit. And it's very difficult to then turn around and admit that once you've built a career, once you have gone through a party political organization and have to agree with things that, even if you don't personally agree with, you've had to say them. As we all know, making a U-turn for our politicians is difficult in the best of times, so to say this at something that is politically difficult to explain to an electorate who are sun readers and knee-jerk reaction, have an instant knee-jerk reaction. We often hear the argument of, but if we legalized these drugs, society would collapse, everyone would start taking drugs. But I ask listeners, I ask you, would you start taking heroin were it legal today? I wouldn't, and I've already said, I have no problem with consuming substances that are technically illegal. But I wouldn't start taking heroin tomorrow because I have no drive to take heroin tomorrow. Right.
Good evening. Usually I talk with you from my office in the West Wing of the White House, but tonight there's something special to talk about, and I've asked someone very special to join me. Nancy and I are here in the West Hall of the White House, and around us are the rooms in which we live. It's the home you've provided for us, of which we merely have temporary custody. Nancy's joining me because the message this evening is not my message, but ours. And we speak to you not simply as fellow citizens, but as fellow parents and grandparents and as concerned neighbors. It's back to school time for America's children, and while drug and alcohol abuse cuts across all generations, it's especially damaging to the young people on whom our future depends. So tonight, from our family to yours, from our home to yours, thank you for joining us. America has accomplished so much in these last few years, whether it's been rebuilding our economy or serving the cause of freedom in the world. What we've been able to achieve has been done with your help, with us working together as a nation united. Now, we need your support again. Drugs are menacing our society. They're threatening our values and undercutting our institutions. They're killing our children. From the beginning of our administration, we've taken strong steps to do something about this horror. Tonight, I can report to you that we've made much progress. 37 federal agencies are working together in a vigorous national effort. And by next year, our spending for drug law enforcement will have more than tripled from its 1981 levels. We have increased seizures of illegal drugs. Shortages of marijuana are now being reported. Last year alone, over 10,000 drug criminals were convicted, and nearly $250 million of their assets were seized by the DEA, the Drug Enforcement Administration. And in the most important area, individual use, we see progress. In 4 years, the number of high school seniors using marijuana on a daily basis has dropped from 1 in 14 to 1 in 20. The U.S. military has cut the use of illegal drugs among its personnel by 67% since 1980. These are a measure of our commitment and emerging signs that we can defeat this enemy. But we still have much to do. Despite our best efforts, illegal cocaine is coming into our country at alarming levels, and 4 to 5 million people regularly use it. 500,000 Americans are hooked on heroin. 1 in 12 persons smoke marijuana regularly. Regular drug use is even higher among the age group 18 to 25, most likely just entering the workforce. Today, there's a new epidemic. Smokable cocaine, otherwise known as crack. It is an explosively destructive and often lethal substance which is crushing its users. It is an uncontrolled fire. And drug abuse is not a so-called victimless crime. Everyone's safety is at stake when drugs and excessive alcohol are used by people on the highways or by those transporting our citizens or operating industrial equipment. Drug abuse costs you and your fellow Americans at least $60 billion a year. From the early days of our administration, Nancy has been intensely involved in the effort to fight drug abuse.
I'm especially concerned about what drugs are doing to young mothers and their newborn children. Listen to this news account from a hospital in Florida of a child born to a mother with a cocaine habit. Nearby, a baby named Paul lies motionless in an incubator, feeding tubes riddling his tiny body. He needs a respirator to breathe and a daily spinal tap to relieve fluid buildup on his brain. Only 1 month old, he's already suffered 2 strokes. Now you can see why drug abuse concerns every one of us, all the American family. Drugs steal away so much. They take and take until finally, every time a drug goes into a child, something else is forced out. Like love and hope and trust and confidence. Drugs take away the dream from every child's heart and replace it with a nightmare. And it's time we in America stand up and replace those dreams. Each of us has to put our principles and consciences on the line, whether in social settings or in the workplace, to set forth solid standards and stick to them. There's no moral middle ground. Indifference is not an option. We want you to help us create an outspoken intolerance for drug use. For the sake of our children, I implore each of you to be unyielding and inflexible in your opposition to drugs.
Right, so you're criticizing the assumption that a lot of politicians make that, oh, if we legalize heroin, everybody's going to start taking heroin.
Exactly. Which seems to be based on the argument of sending messages. This is quite often what we hear when cannabis in the UK, for example, was brought down to a Class C drug. It was then brought back up to a Class B because it was believed by Theresa May, the Home Secretary at the time, that it sent the wrong message. It sent the wrong message to kids. And I don't believe we should be ruining adults' lives in order to send messages to kids.
That's a really interesting point. Now, earlier I heard you talk about the morality of drugs, and in your opinion, is there a moral issue with an individual taking drugs?
I think it is a moral issue on...
Or more bluntly, is it morally wrong to take drugs?
No, I don't think it is. There's a very interesting book called Saying Yes, by Jacob Silver, in which he essentially says the modern media has overly exaggerated the risk of all the substances. They have completely over-exaggerated, and there is actually a basic human drive to change your state of mind, whether it be through meditation, whether it be through extreme sports, throwing yourself off a bridge with no protection in the legs, or whether it be through taking substances. If we look at societies across the world, every society has some way of intoxicating themselves. They either smoke cannabis, or they chew crack, or they
From personal experience in the Middle East or in Iran or Iraq or local countries around the area, the cigarettes are very common because they're seen as a stress relief for them or meditation, and quite often they have a special blend of tea that calms them. That's supposed to be for, so yeah, you can see that
changing one state of mind through ingesting substances is not something that as human beings we appear to have a drive to do. It is a quintessential part of being a human being. And only up until very recently, only really with the war on drugs, has it been seen as a negative. Previously to this, you would have shaman, wise men, council elders, the people in society who were looked up to were drug takers. Benjamin Franklin, for example. George Washington, both of these people were thought of as like geniuses of their time. But both smoked weed. Abraham Lincoln was a chronic weed smoker.
Yeah. Do you think that religion is part of the force that's trying to that's going after drugs? So we've pointed out that there seems to be a human nature to change one's mental state through either ingesting something or jumping off a bridge or something, as you said, through adrenaline. Do you think that religion is part of the problem that's really stirring up more of a, making it seem like more of a problem than it is?
Oh, you mean setting up that moral?
Oh, you shouldn't. Yeah, the foreign, God tells you not to to take drugs or not to drink alcohol, or do you think that's a separate issue in itself? And we should focus on it.
I can see why religion would be used to, or why religious doctrine could be used to propagate the idea of intoxication being bad, but I don't know that it's something inherent in religion itself. I think I would have to be a more sort of in-depth analysis of each religion.
Right. So we've spoken about what the war on drugs is and why it's failing. I know it's not quite. It's wrong to say, well, if you were in charge, if you were the prime minister or president of this country, that's kind of hearsay, but what is a solution in your mind to the war on drugs, and if it's failing, what can we do? What else can we do?
Well, personally, I'm in favour of legalisation. I disagree with the idea of decriminalisation. Well, I should set out my position first before I tell you why the other ones are wrong. I would regulate all drugs as we do. Tobacco and alcohol, with the exception of heroin. Heroin, I would follow the Dutch model of if you are willing to become a registered user, admitting to the government, I take heroin and would like help, they will provide it free of charge for you. It is as with any, not even prescription drugs, because they were charging for prescriptions.
Are they weaning you off of it eventually, slowly though?
Yes,
so they're not just providing you with free heroin.
But it doesn't. But they're not providing, say, methadone, which heroin users take and then take heroin in order to. They take methadone to top up their own heroin supply.
Right.
Because in Holland they essentially give you free heroin as much as you want, but is under the understanding that you would be going to these clinics, you would be having sort of psychological help for whatever reason, because very rarely do people wake up one day and go, I think I'm going to try heroin.
Yeah.
You know, they don't have like a really nice house and a family and kids and that kind of thing, and then decide to start taking heroin. It's often because of some trauma that they are hiding from in the past. Speaking from my own experience, it was an attempt to distance myself from emotional trouble that I was having at the time, which is what really started me taking substances. So I think to criminalise people who, although yes, at the moment, may be doing harm to society or themselves, I mean, I disagree with that, but even to criminalise these people for taking drugs, yes, but you're only taking a snippet of their life. You're not understanding why these people are the way they are. Which I think is an important thing to understand with drugs, that it's not. Very rarely.
Yeah. You seem to have drawn the line at heroin.
Yes, heroin, I would say, or opiates in general, because there is a 96% addiction rating to it, I believe. That is to say, 96% of people who take heroin once become
addicted to it.
Yeah, just 96% of people. Even cocaine, I think, has around 86%. So even that is nowhere near the same as heroin.
Mm-hmm.
But other drugs, I would be perfectly willing to allow people to consume as they saw fit. I think by making them illegal, you are encouraging things like the designer drugs, things like methadone, all of the, which was quite big a few years ago. You're encouraging people to slightly change the chemical composition of a chemical of a illegal drug and make it a legal one. So it just doesn't work. So whereas if you give people a controllable supply of their drug of choice, they will be far less likely to try other things.
Do you not think the legality of drugs or the decriminalization of drugs will not so much encourage kids or teenagers in doing them, but whereas now the criminalization of drugs is not so much a deterrent, but you understand that it's illegal, and if you do it, there's a chance to get caught, or there's some sort of punishment behind it.
It's a conscious decision to...
Do you think legalization or decriminalization is sending a message that it's okay, or do you think that society is smarter than that? Because I think that's a leap of faith of taking that thinking. Wouldn't rightly so. I personally would agree. I don't think that if you legalized heroin tomorrow, then everybody would be taking heroin, or every kid in the school would be taking heroin. Otherwise, you'd need to fix your education system if that's the
issue. Absolutely. I think that's more of a serious indictment of something else in society.
Yeah. Do you think that it's sending a message out that it's okay, and that legalization or decriminalization is going to encourage kids to take drugs?
I don't know that taking drugs per se is something we should be attempting to stop people from doing. However, I do agree that children shouldn't be taking these drugs. While the brain is still developing, personally, I would have a limit on these things of, say, 21 years old, because at that point, the neurochemical composition of your brain is sort of settled down, and you are the person who would be going through puberty, that kind of thing. But if we look at examples of like Holland, we see that 22% of the population of Holland have ever smoked cannabis in their entire life, with only 5.4% of them in 2004 and 2005 having smoked it. Now this is in comparison to the USA, for example, which in the same time period, 2004-2005, 10.3% of people smoked cannabis in that year. Now in the USA, if you get caught with cannabis three times, you're going to prison for life.
That I didn't know.
Yeah, I believe it's in certain states that three strikes in a row.
In one state, that's ridiculous.
Yeah, exactly. It's ridiculous. You get caught with cannabis three times, that's it, you're in prison for life. So obviously stricter penalties don't...
They don't work it.
Yeah, they don't work. I mean, there were 40% of people in the USA who have smoked cannabis in their entire life. This is... If the numbers were the other way around, then we could have a serious debate about whether legalization encourages use. But when we look at things like Portugal, when we look at Holland, I mean, Portugal, for example, has been an amazing victory for the more liberal decriminalization and legalization fight. They had a 63% increase in people in treatment when they decriminalized in 2001. 62% increase. They've had a 499% increase in drug seizures in Portugal. So they've had almost a 500% increase in the amount of drugs that they are seizing off people, despite the fact that they've stopped seizing it off people on the street, like users. They've had a 50% decrease from the original thing, before the 63% increase in those in treatment. They've had a 50% increase in that original number of those in treatment over the past 11 years. They've also had a 50% decrease over the last 11 years of people who are overdosing and drug-related diseases like hepatitis, AIDS, that kind of thing. So Portugal is a shining example of how, granted, the counterintuitive thing of allowing people to do it and not punishing people for doing it does not encourage people to do more. It actually appears to discourage people. It appears to discourage people from doing it because, I mean, granted, on a purely hearsay basis, Dutch friends that I have say, why would I want to smoke cannabis? I walk down the street and see tourists and essentially losers sat in coffee shops all day, giggling at their feet, or laughing at their own hands, or unable to string a sentence together. Why would I want to go do that? Because it's seen as alcoholics.
Yeah,
it's something you can do.
Finally, with the legalization, essentially a lot of drugs would become a profit tool for conglomerates and corporations. Do you think that with the legalization of certain drugs, that they can be misused for profit? I'll use the example of the hot topic in the UK right now with the horse meat and the mince meat, where a profit-oriented organization has misused its power, and it hasn't, you know, do you know what I mean? Production's been
not up to
quality for the reason of profit because there's recession going on. Do you get the line that I'm drawing?
Yeah.
Do you reckon that?
I would, although I agree that yes, that is a possibility. The horse meat scandal has shown us that the food that we consume is not what we produce, and that there can be very immoral people out there who will screw people over for money. It's a simple fact.
They've done it in every line of society.
Absolutely. Yeah. It happens everywhere. It's not something we can get away from until we can get rid of the jealousy part of human beings, the desire to own more things. I would argue, however, that legalizing would, giving this to corporations, to companies to produce, would in fact decrease the chance of this happening. Because there would be legal restrictions upon them, where if we, with criminalizing any substance, anything, you instantly hand that market to immoral individuals who are not answerable to any government, who are only answerable, more than likely, to the big scary man above them, who will hurt them. This is the reality of the high end drug deal. Whereas in companies and corporations, you're very unlikely to get your thumbs broken if you go do a certain business transaction. Whereas we all know through PSA and through stories in the media that this happens in illegal drug circles. So I would agree that yes, it is possible for big companies to abuse the power and to make
and that regulation products wouldn't be as easy as we would imagine for it to
exactly
be.
Exactly, but I think we are we are living in fear of a dystopic future. We are not addressing our dystopic present.
Mm-hmm.
The fear that a company like Monsanto, like Nestle, for example, will take cocaine and it won't be what you're buying, they will cut it down, they will, whatever the fears may be of, I argue that by making it illegal, you are giving it to the same kind of people, the same kind of things can happen. They have no regulation. There's absolutely no regulation, whereas at least making it legal and giving it to companies would make it, you'd have some sort of control over it.
Alrighty. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
It's been very enlightening, in fact. It's a topic that no one really talked about within society anyway. It's a hot topic within political spheres, but no one really understands that there is a war on drugs within Parliament or within Congress going on, and that it's a failing endeavour. Thank you for listening to us this week. Join us on our next episode, where we'll be talking. There will be a special episode with a debate on a highly controversial topic of gay marriage. Follow us on Twitter again at @C_Observer and like us on Facebook at facebook.com/Central Observer. Thank you very much. I get a feeling there's going to be a riot. I don't read the newspapers because they all have ugly print. At the starting of the week, at Summit Talks you'll hear them speak. It's only Monday. Negotiations breaking down. See those leaders start to frown. It's Sword and Gun Day. Tomorrow never comes until it's too late. Come with it. Another bomb. Tomorrow is another day.